Welcome everyone to today's CCG call. Today we're joined again by Dr. Greg Bernstein, who's going to talk to us about some of the more in-depth features, advanced features of BBS Plus, in particular holder binding. So it's going to be a deep technical talk, but I'm really excited about it. Some interesting features here, hopefully, we can all learn about. Before we get into that, just some admin. So first up, code of ethics and professional conduct. So I think we're great at this here, but, you know, treat everyone with respect and let's have a fruitful, productive conversation here and on the mailing list, please. Next, IP note. So anyone is welcome to participate in these calls. However, substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. So if you aren't a full member of the CCG and you would like to participate in our work items, please get in touch and we can help you join and sign this agreement. So call notes, these calls are done through Jitsi and generally we manage the chat in just Jitsi chat, but there's also IRC channel you can join and Q plus to mention something or raise your hand and we'll manage the queue. Okay, introductions, reintroductions. Is there anyone new here who would like to say hello to the community or anyone who hasn't said hi in a while and just wants to unmute and say hi? We'd love to hear from you. Okay, not seeing anyone. We'll continue. If anyone wants to say hello, jump off mute and say it, that's fine. Okay, announcements and reminders. Does anyone here have any announcements or reminders for the community to share? Please jump on the queue. Manu.
Just a couple of quick ones. The first one, I'll put the link in. The World Wide Web Consortium's technical plenary is coming up. There are a number of us that are going in their breakout sessions already that have been raised here. Of interest to this community is a one around DID method standardization. So I'll put that link in here. And so that is going to involve Kim and Gabe and possibly myself speaking to some of the advancements that we've been making with other communities, DIFF, IOTA, W3C, this community, you know, on DID method standardization. So there'll be an active discussion happening, at TPAC about that. There is also going to be a breakout session around, the future of verifiable credentials, that includes new features that a number of people in the community are planning. We'll have an agenda up shortly, but, you know, expect a lot of discussion there. And then a couple of other ones, you know, popped up that are of interest. One of them by Tim Capali, which I think who just joined, on identity-related web platform APIs and harmonizing them. That has to do with, like, you know, the digital credential API and web authn and FedCM API and that sort of thing. So, lots of cool stuff happening, at TPAC this year. If you have a breakout session that you want to propose, please get it on the agenda there. The other, real quick, heads up is that, the controller document, so this is a DID document basically, had been moving fairly rapidly through the process, but as of 2 weeks ago, there have been a number of issues raised on it. If you care about DID documents or the future of them, you might want to pay attention to the pull requests and the issues in that repository. You'll see that there are like 100 comments, you know, raised issues and PRs and whatever last week. So just a heads up to keep an eye on that. Nothing major, but, you know, something to keep an eye on. That's it for updates from me.
Thanks, Martin. And Harrison reminded me, yeah, so I will be at TPAC, and we won't be having a call that week, so that's the 24th of September. We'll be off. Okay, any final announcements or reminders from anyone else? Not seeing any. So a brief touch on work items. I don't have anything particular to present, but I am aware of a couple of people working on some new work item proposal. I don't see them on the call, so I guess, yeah, keep your eyes peeled. Hopefully some new work will be coming through the CCG soon. Yeah, that's everything from me, so I'll hand over to Greg or to the presentation. Take it away, Greg.
All right, let's get screen sharing going again of the window. I am being cautious in using a different browser because I have so many security plugins on my browser that both Chrome and Firefox, that sometimes things don't work. So if I seem like I'm tripping around my browser, it's because I'm not as used to Brave, but it seems to be working. Okay. So this is kind of a continuation from June 24th or so when I previously talked about extra features, privacy enhancing features associated with BBS. And there was just a little bit that we didn't get to. But the thing is, we got to put things into context. And after the talk, people are saying, well, you forgot to tell us about these properties of this thing and such like that. And so we're going to bring this up a level before we get down into the mud. Okay. So I know somebody said we're going to get very technical, but let's go back over attacks on credentials. And before we get to anonymous holder binding, and even before we get to what I would call public key-based holder binding, we'll review how we deal with some replay attacks or could with our current credential schemes, okay? So that's the plan because, yeah, we just had this little thing and it was just a little more application of the cryptography we learned about. But if we take that back up and put it into context with what's going on, how people are trying to do things and some current issues that are going on with UD wallets and things like that, it becomes a lot more important and more interesting. So we're not going to just start off where we left off last time. Who am I? I've been helping with the crypto suite specs, the data integrity things. I've been helping out with the BBS specs over at the IETF. Okay. And I do some, do a bunch of help with like the test vectors, the examples that are in these things. Okay. And I finally created a little page on my website where I put like links to the presentations, the one demonstration. I don't have pseudonym demonstration in a good enough shape where I want to let people play with it and they'll go, your coding isn't. Okay. So that's the previous demonstration. The various links to the current things I've been editing, IETF, and all the code that we use to like, or that I use to generate those test vectors. So this is all open source, JavaScript, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So one page, I put it so you can get to all of it, and I can. So one problem is all my different figures are different sizes. Credential attacks. Okay. We have a three-party model for credentials. Issuers, holders, and verifiers. So I was very confused after I gave my pseudonym talk and somebody kept telling me, you forgot to tell about how pseudonyms help prevent Evil Alice. I go, I don't even know who Evil Alice is. Okay. And we're going to get to that. But they were thinking about in cryptography, we have A and B, Alice and Bob, and in a two-party model, you have Alice and Bob, and you can have evil Bob or good Bob and Alice. Okay. So if you hear somebody talking about evil Alice or evil Bob, that's what they mean. But this is, I've got evil issuers, evil holders, and evil verifiers. Okay. As well as somebody out there who's going to be our credential stealer. Now, BBS, what's the deal with that? We talked about tracking, okay? And we talked about BBS producing unlinkable signatures, meaning the cryptographic values in those signatures, those random looking numbers, okay? If not done properly, the verifiers can talk to each other and say, hey, you know, I can identify the holder by stuff in the signatures within the secured credential, and so we can track them from site to site. Okay? That's what I mean by an evil verifier. An evil issuer, meaning maybe the verifiers report back to the issuer without the holder's knowledge or consent. There's a legitimate reasons to do these things, right? There's a legitimate reasons to understand who's doing what out there, but people should know when they're being tracked, okay? Illegitimate reasons are, you know, we want to figure out how to sell you more something that you really don't need, okay? Third model is this, is the verifiers all report to some third party what holder's been visiting them. And we learned that one of the key things about BBS style signatures is the cryptographic information is unlinkable. Okay. So the cryptography is not the problem. With other types of signatures, okay, or schemes, cryptography schemes, those values are unique and can be used for tracking. Whether that's an issue depends on the application, but we are trying to be privacy preserving here. Now, besides evil issuers and verifier tracking around the net, we have to worry about stolen credential use, right? So using a verifiable credential without the holder's consent or knowledge, okay? And how could that happen? Intercepting credentials between issuer and holder, or holder and verifier, or a data breach at the issuer, holder, or verifier, right? Any of those things happens all the time. We get those notices. Then there's another kind, and this is the evil Alice case. So complicit credential abuse, the illicit use of a credential with complicity of the credentials holder, okay? Somebody other than the intended holder is using credentials with the holder's knowledge, right? Oh, you want to see something from that website? I already paid for it. Here, use my thing, and I'm going to sell it off to all sorts of people. Okay, so account sharing beyond contracted limits, not me sharing my subscription to the Times or the Economist with my kids because we all just read it once in a while, right? You know, that's within the contracted limits. Restrictions, evasions, age limits. Okay. One of the things is unlinkability can make this abuse easier because you can't tell when somebody comes back if they're the same person, right? So you could easily set this up so somebody could allow other people to use their credential in a unlinkable way. Okay. Now, last time we talked about these pseudonym things, and it's like, oh, they keep you from being tracked, but they allow the verifier to remember you so you can have services from that verifier, blah, blah, and have a relationship with them. But they also help mitigate this kind of credential abuse. And was just on a email thread with some folks on blind BBS signatures and pseudonyms talking about more examples of this, and like for voting systems, even. Not saying we're using this for voting systems. Okay. So we have credential stealing, credential abuse, we have tracking. What about forging credentials? Okay. Well, the truth is this is extremely difficult. This is what cryptographic papers and algorithms are all about. Okay. If you could forge a credential, say an ECDSA or EDDSA signature, we would stop using it. Okay. That's why we move on to different types of cryptography. Okay. It is difficult. If they are implemented correctly, oh, and the key is kept secret. So you may wonder, it's like, why do these guys always talk about these methods where they can figure out a couple extra bits of the key? You know, all these weird things, timing attacks, and looking at the power used by the cryptographic processor. Anything that gets them a little more information of the key, about the key, means they can try and guess the key easier than all those values. So generally, people try and get around the cryptographic algorithms. If they're implemented correctly, if the key's kept secret, you've got to go around it. And that's where they concentrate a lot of their attacks. So our job is to make sure we use the cryptography properly. Okay. So let's look at some mechanisms, questions. I'm not looking at the chat because I'm sharing my screen. So if there's questions, somebody will let me know. So mitigating stolen credentials. Now, the first set of these is kind of like it's being stolen between the holder and the verifier, right? So it's got intercepted or somebody hacked the holder, okay? And these would be normally talked about as replay attacks, okay? And we've got some mechanisms generally in verifiable credentials to deal with these. There's something called a challenge. So in the VC data integrity and the model, there's a challenge value. And then in data integrity, when you verify your proof, you're supposed to do something with that value. So let's look at that flow. And you'll notice the flow is kind of long and complicated. The verifier comes up with a fresh challenge value for the holder to use. Now the holder can't do anything with that because they don't issue the credential. They have to take that challenge value, send it over to the issuer. The issuer secures a VC, including a proof with the covering the challenge value. Okay. The holder then sends that back to the verifier, and we can tell we don't like this flow. Why? Because we have to go back to the issuer at some time to get this done, right? So it's okay, but not what we think about, okay? So holder has to get issuer involved in providing a fresh challenge value. Okay, let's look at a different cryptographic scheme and its support for this, okay? In BBS, there's something known as the presentation header. We'll remind folks about this in a sec, okay? In the BBS IETF draft, it talks about presentation header, particularly for using this. In the verifiable credential W3C spec, we give you hooks to use the presentation header. What does the flow look like? Oops, not yet. Sorry. I'm going to remind you that BBS is a three-party model. Okay? They'll use the term signer, prover, and verifier. We use the terms issuer, holder, and verifier. Okay? So issuer to holder. The issuer uses the sign function covering multiple messages, right? We take our verifiable credential, we do our JSON-LD processing, end up with a bunch of messages, statements, okay? Sign that, send the signature and the messages over to the holder. The holder can verify that if they wanted to, okay? But the holder uses a separate procedure called ProofGen. Notice no secret key of the issuer is involved. It just has the private key, public key, sorry. It has the signature involved. It's got a header. The header information is information that must be shared by all parties. So how do we make use of that with verifiable credentials in the DI spec for BBS? We put things like mandatory reveal information in that header. All parties must share it. However, this presentation header thingy is only shared between the holder and the verifier. In addition, it's secured. Okay. So we have a model that looks like this. The issuer uses BBS to sign a VC, sends it to the holder. A verifier sends information like a challenge, but we don't call it a challenge. It doesn't have to be incorporated in the VC directly, over to the holder, containing what they want to see in the presentation header. Okay. The holder creates another secure VC, what we call a derived proof. Okay. Different languages based on W3C versus, okay. We have a base proof we put into the signed VC, a derived proof, and the secure VC. We put in the presentation header. Okay. That is secured with the BBS algorithm, and the verifier can verify it. So BBS has a built-in anti-replay flow. Okay. We don't have to go back to the issuer to do that. Okay. Nice to know. Question.
Yeah, I have a question. Greg. I'm a little confused, like with your flow with the data integrity, because you get all confused. That's where the data integrity and the challenge gets forwarded on to the issuer. Like, my understanding was, like, if you wanted to do replay protection, I guess, I mean, maybe because in this flow you don't have a presentation, right? Like, my understanding is the verifier would send a challenge to the holder would then use that challenge when creating a signature from their holder did in a presentation.
Okay, so... I don't bring up presentation here. So the holder would then come up with a presentation and sign the presentation.
For the challenge.
Yeah. So then we have to have the holder's public key known to the verifier, and we'll have the issuer's public key known to the verifier.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hit something like that in a second. So, okay. Yeah, that's a completely legit way to do it, too. We're going to see something like that in a second, where we have both issuer and holders having public-private key pairs, and we'll use that for a little bit more security. So,
I think maybe
I don't give a fair shift to challenge being used here. But let's take a look at the next level of security where we bind, and we'll see that once the holder has a, okay. So that leads us to the next issue. Okay. Well, what if we want to make sure that it's really coming from the holder? Okay. How do we bind the credential to a holder? We've been hearing more demands for this. Okay. The UD wallet people have gotten, and we'll talk about how far they want to go with it. Okay. So how does this work? The holder is going to have a public-private key pair for creating digital signatures, such as ECDSA type signatures. Something we use with credentials. The public key from the holder, the holder's public key is sent to the issuer for inclusion in the credential that is sent back to the holder. Why does the holder need to get their public key back? Oh, when requesting the credential, the verifier also includes a message acting as a test. The holder signs this message with their private key. Oh, and includes it with the credential sent to the verifier. Are you keeping all this in your head? We're going to see a diagram in a second. Okay, so we have two different sets of public-private keys. The holder's public key gets sent to the issuer and incorporated into the credential. The verifier is going to send a test message or a nonce or web challenge or whatever you want to call it to the holder to sign. The verifier then validates the signature on the test message with the holder's public key that was contained in the VC and verifies it with this credential with the issuer's public key. Ah, let's look at the diagram. Okay. The holder has a public key. The issuer has a public key. The holder sends their public key to the issuer. The issuer signs the VC with their secret key, but also includes a copy, which is signed over, of the holder's public key. So they're saying, look, I'm issuing this credential to the holder, and the holder, I've verified somehow that the holder, this is the holder's public key. Okay. Only the holder should have the secret key. Okay. They don't send the secret key to the issuer. Okay. The verifier can send a test message, whatever they like, can also be used for anti-replay. Okay. So what does the holder do? They're going to forward on the secured VC, which the issuer, remember, signed over their public key, and they're going to sign this test message they got from the verifier. The verifier then does two things. They verify this credential with the issuer's public key. They make sure it's from the issuer, okay? From the credential, they pull out what the issuer said is the holder's public key, and they verify the signed test message with that public key, meaning only the holder who has its secret key corresponding to the public key could have created and signed the test message. So they verified two things. Okay. They verified the credential and they verified that only the credential could have, this combination of things could have come from the holder because only the holder knows the secret key. So this is strong holder binding. Okay. The issuer issued it to the holder knowing that the holder had this public key and only the holder has the secret key. Hopefully, right? If they lose the secret key or if somebody else gets the secret key, all bets are off. Okay. So we see anti-replay. We see a nice flow here. Notice if you go to another verifier, okay, the holder doesn't have to go back to the issuer. All they have to do is get a different test message from this other verifier, send them the secure VC and another signed test message. So we don't have that icky flow like we saw before. Okay. Pros: prevents anyone from using the credential without the holder's consent. And it's as strong as the ability of the holder to keep their private key secret. Or to make sure there's no fraud in this over here between the holder and the issuer, right? Right. If somebody's trying to impersonate the holder and get the issuer, that's another process, right? Remember, the cryptography, when implemented well, is strong, very strong. So people are going to do whatever they can to get around it. Okay. And that's where the rest of us come in, right? We're not cryptographers, but we have to make sure how we handle the rest of these things. Or we know about the cryptography. We have to handle the rest of these things in a secure way. But we'll look at the con. The holder's public key in a VC is a unique identifier for the holder and allows tracking on every credential use. This public key value is unique. It better be because it corresponds to the holder's secret key. If two people have the same public key, that means they have the same secret key essentially. Or good enough. Okay. So this public key holder binding flow doesn't stop the tracking. Okay. Very secure. Okay. So people are going to try and get around things. They're going to try and steal the private keys. So you want to put your private key someplace really safe so no one can steal it. You only want to use it in a really safe place so nobody can look at it and learn it, okay? And this is why people are talking about trusted execution environments and trusted platform modules and the like associated with wallets and things like that. Okay. There's these things called TPMs. If you've got a modern laptop, PC or whatever, most likely you have one in it. Windows, I think starting in Windows 11 or 10 required one. This diagram shows an older block diagram of a TPM. Okay. But what do they have in them? They've got random number generators. They have algorithms. They implement algorithms. TPM 2.0 includes elliptic curve cryptography, the kind of stuff we have for ECDSA, EDDSA for credentials, because those are more efficient, especially as far as key sizes. Okay. So sometimes you'll hear these called hardware-based roots of trust, okay? And people, hardware manufacturers make chips for everything from laptops to IoT devices that can do these kind of things, okay? So they'll generate random, secure random numbers. They can generate key pairs. They can do all sorts of good things. What we care about is key pair generation. Remember that public and private key pair. Okay. Only the public key ever comes out. Private keys never would leave the secure element. Now, in addition to doing this in hardware, you can also do this in a secure piece of software. That's that trusted execution or secure element things. So how secure and such like that, how you achieve that. Okay. But private keys never leave the secure element unless they are encrypted. That's one trick that they figured out with TPMs. It's like, oh, people might have a lot of public-private key pairs. We can export them right out of the TPM as long as they are encrypted. Okay. They call that key wrapping. So we have private, so we have that protection. We have key pair generation, protecting the private keys if you need to have a lot of them. And you can sign things. Okay. That's where people get very excited. We'll have this in this root of trust. Okay. But remember, once you got something really nice and secure, somebody's going to go around it. They're going to subvert it. They're going to take over it and things like that. Okay. So they can extract the private keys. That's what they're good for, but they'll go around, try and go around it any way possible. We get in all sorts of issues about how do apps get fair access so somebody else can make a wallet and things like that. Is it going to be limited just to the right now getting control or being able to use those secure elements is quite limited. The hardware can be slow to evolve. Okay. Current ECC support in these things is limited to specific curves and specific signing algorithms. Okay. People are pushing to modernize these things and such. But remember, do we always need this level of security? Can we always get it? Right now, should we halt all innovation just because we don't have a hardware root of trust? No. I've been on many conversations lately with cryptographers, and they say, oh, yeah, we need a secure platform to do our discussions and such like that. We'll use Signal. That's done in software. But all the algorithms are open source. All the cryptographers have been able to see how Signal implements their protocols and such like that. And everybody says, that's good. And Signal came out first, and then other people came out and did those things later, right? WhatsApp, Google, something or other, messaging uses Signal's algorithms. Okay, so how are we going to make this anonymous? Guess what? We're going to use BBS. Okay. Now, we had this public key holder binding, and we got some cool concepts from it. Okay. Giving the verifier's public key allows the holder, okay, giving the verifier the holder's public key allows the holder to prove that they know a secret, right? Because I'm going to sign whatever you give to me, okay? And you can use my public key to verify that I knew the secret key that corresponded it by checking the signature. Oh, okay. So I'm able to kind of prove something to the verifier. They know this thing, though, that identifies me. That's a downside. The public key is bound to the private key, okay? But public key is linked to the secret key and doesn't hide the holder. Ooh, we learned about something like this last time with pseudonyms. This is what cryptographers kind of call a commitment or a commitment scheme. Allows one to commit to a chosen secret value while keeping it hidden from others with the ability to reveal it later. Okay. Commitment schemes are designed so that a party cannot change the value or statement they have after they've committed it to it. Okay. There's two main properties, cryptographic properties. Binding. Once a commitment is generated, Alice can only open it to a single message. No changing the message after the commitment has been made. Hiding. This is what we don't get with the public key-based holder binding. The commitment string C should reveal no information about the committed message. Okay, even if the message set is under control of the adversary. For us, we don't want to be tracked. Ah. Now, last time we said, there's a number of ways you can come up with commitment schemes. Let M be the message being committed or value. Choose a random R. Take a hash of the concatenation of the message with the random value R. Hash functions, cryptographic hash functions, you can't reverse them. Okay, you can't figure out the M from the value of the commitment and the R value. If you could, you'd be a Bitcoin billionaire, right? Because that's what a lot of those Bitcoin proof of works are. All checking hash function values and wasting a tremendous amount of energy and natural resources. Okay, verification on reveal of M by checking. Oh, so you can... There's another type of commitment that's fairly famous. This uses these things called groups, prime order groups, and they're based on the difficulty of the discrete logarithm problem, which is the same as ECDSA, EDDSA, and BBS is tied to the discrete logarithm problem, right? Or if you didn't know. So how these work... Let X be the number, the message to be committed. Let R be another random number. We call that the blinding or hiding factor. And to compute the commitment as simply as raising this number G, called a generator, to the power X, and H multiplied by H to the power R. Okay. Now you're going, but if we reveal the secret, wait. What good is committing to this thing and hiding it with this commitment if we have to reveal it? Oh. That's where we get to the modern stuff. That's where we get to things called zero knowledge proofs. Because what we're not ever going to do is reveal the value X. What we're going to do is we're going to prove that we know these values. But we're going to prove it in what's called zero knowledge. Okay, so you've heard about these things. So let's talk about them a bit so you'll know the jargon. Okay, we're not going to do the proofs like we went through a little bit last time. I put the slides in, but I know we're going to run out of time. And we want to have some time for questions. So, zero knowledge proofs. Okay, they have to satisfy three things. It's a procedure that goes on between a prover and a verifier, okay? Hence the terminology in the BBS draft where you have a signer, an approver, and a verifier. BBS uses a zero-knowledge proof between the prover and the verifier to prove that they know all the messages and the signature on the message, and the signature corresponds to those sets of messages. Okay, So they're not just saying, I know the signature, but I know the signature corresponds to this particular set of messages, and I know the messages. Okay. So it's a procedure that goes on between these two folks. It's complete. If you run the protocol, okay, and the statement's true, the verifier will accept it. Okay. So if you truly know the signature, you truly know the messages, and they all correspond to each other, you follow the procedure, the verifier will accept it. They use the term sound, meaning your argument is sound, to say if the statement is false, the verifier follows the protocol. The verifier cannot be convinced. Okay. You can't fool me. The prover can't prove to you. Okay. With the protocol, if they don't really know the information. Okay. So you can't, that's the you can't fool me property. Complete means you'll accept it if it's really true property. And zero knowledge means you're not going to learn anything extra other than the fact the statement is true. I know the secret value. Okay. There is, you don't need to have this public key or this extra stuff. Okay. To accept my proof of it. I'm going to give you this proof of it, but you're not going to learn anything other than I know the value. Okay. Just in case when you read some of these things and you hear about ZK snarks and ZK starks and such like that, to be technical, proofs need to be sound. Remember, you can't fool me, even against computationally unbounded provers. So the provers can have all the computer power in the world. That's the formal definition of proof. Where an argument only needs to preserve the you can't fool me property against limited computations. Okay? So that's the more technical term. Hence, if you go and look up things, zero knowledge, you'll hear people talking about zero knowledge proofs in general, okay? But when they try and get more technical, you'll see acronyms like ZK-SNARK, zero knowledge, succinct, non-interactive, those things. Succinct meaning short, non-interactive meaning we've compressed this into a single round. We don't have to go back and forth and back and forth. Argument for knowledge. Argument is the more correct technical term, but we just use proof to talk about these things in general. Okay. Took me a while. I was like, why are these guys talking about arguments while the whole thing is called a proof? Technical thing. Okay. So just to summarize, the BBS proof provided by a holder to a verifier is a zero knowledge proof. BBS has been using this stuff and has been around this type, okay, for quite a while. There's a lot of current work still going on ZKPs because they're trying to prove more general things. BBS uses ZKPs of a certain form, proving very specific types of statements, okay. That's why BBS, though, gets away with very small proofs and very small signatures and very efficient compared to other ZKP techniques. Okay. Now, with BBS, each proof generated uses a different set of cryptographic random numbers, and hence different proofs cannot be linked to each other. Okay. That's where we get that good untrackability, unlinkability. Okay, here's a repeat of what I said with the references to tell you where to see these things. And folks, we're getting some interest with these things and standardizing this set of proof techniques, okay? So just to let you know, that's some current work at ZK. The ZK proof folks are talking about taking some of that and bringing that over the IATF. We're talking with them to see how to incorporate more general proofs of things into things. Now, you may be using a bunch of this stuff already, but an example of this commitment stuff and a zero knowledge proof of the commitment got incorporated into Signal. Okay. So here's a little bit about Signal private messaging. Okay. Not to be confused with other things that, okay. Once again, their algorithms, okay, and their security protocols are used in WhatsApp, Google Messages, and other things. Okay. In February this year, they announced usernames. Okay. So you don't need to share your phone number. Okay. And I just discovered, as I've been working on pseudonym stuff, this nice article that explains their use of usernames along with these zero-knowledge proofs based on these discrete log things. Okay. The usernames are also kept secret from Signal. Signal also does something similar with if you set up groups, like we have a family chat in Signal, we add all these members, they keep that information nice and private. Okay. People can't see who's talking to who the same way. Okay. As you can on other social media platforms, because it's not a social media platform. It's a private messaging app. Okay. So the usernames consist of a nickname and a number. Okay. With like WinCadet1117. Okay. That's not really my username, but I just wanted to have an example. They compute a commitment. Kind of just like that flavor of what we call the Peterson commitment, okay? They take a hash, kind of randomizes things, times it by a group element. This is actually something called scalar multiplication, okay? They take the nickname, turn it into a number, do a scalar multiplication with the group element, and finally they take that number and do this scalar raise G3 to a power. They send this information. Okay. This is sent by Signal to Signal by the owner of the username. Okay. Signal never sees the username, only the commitment to the username. Okay. To connect with another user, you must know their username. They had to tell you it. You can't get it from Signal. Okay. And you don't even tell it to Signal. What you do is compute the commitment along with a proof. A zero knowledge proof that you know the username. Wait. We saw this before. Oh yeah. When we talked about pseudonyms, we said the prover or us, the holder, will have a secret value. Okay. They'll compute a commitment to that value along with one of these zero knowledge proofs of knowledge. Okay. And they'll keep some information to themselves about how they blinded it, that blinding factor. They can send that over to the issuer who can then check to make sure using the proof procedure that these guys really know this value without revealing the value. And we use this for what we called hidden PID pseudonym. It was used to generate pseudonyms without anybody knowing anything about the pseudonyms. No tracking possible. Well, except the verifier will be able to know you and see you again, but they can't correlate you across other verifiers. So we did this stuff kind of before. Okay. This is what Signal does. Okay. So we talked about this as like a Peterson commitment. It just has a lot more, instead of just one secret value, it broke it up into multiple secret values. Okay, we're not going to review the interactive proofs or the proof of correctness. We did still. Now, what do we do with this stuff? There's something known as a blind signature. You can ask somebody to sign something for you without them actually knowing it. Okay, it's a cryptographic thing. Okay, BBS can support blind signatures. We have a draft, okay, on how to do it, okay? And how does it work? You make a commitment. The holder makes a commitment. They provide a commitment, a proof, a zero-knowledge proof that they actually know the value, ship both the commitment and the proof of the zero-knowledge proof of the commitment to the issuer, The issuer can verify the proof and use that commitment straight and sign that commitment. Okay. So what does the signature API look like? It looks like just what I said. The issuer has their secret key, their public key. They get a commitment with proof from the holder, and that everything looks kind of the same. The interesting thing is when we do blind proof generation, the holder can have a whole set of committed messages. This is general blind signatures. Okay. We're just going to have one. Okay. And they don't have to reveal them, or they can reveal them. Okay. So this is a more general protocol than we need for holder binding. Okay. Scary formula, but I just wanted to show you here. We do all these multiplications and this is done in the right order. Okay. We have the commitment formula. Okay. We have a value in the group. We have a secret prover blind to blind it. We have a bunch of committed messages from the holder, not to be confused with the issuer messages. We're just talking about one message, the secret for holder binding, but there could be others, like for use in pseudonyms. The signing formula for BBS signatures takes place in two main pieces. This is down right in the guts of how BBS works. It has some stuff in it to help do randomization and important things cryptographically, but the core part is taking another set of these generators and combining them with all the messages from the issuer. And I took these from two different specs, so they are not differentiated, sorry. But then it adds in the commitment. Oh, so it all kind of looks the same. Then we do the final signing formula. This is why BBS works so well with blind signatures with very little change. The cryptography is the same. We just have this extra procedure of the commitment with proof. So what does our flow look like here? Okay, anonymous holder binding flow. The holder generates the secret. They keep it secret. They generate a commitment to the secret, and they generate a proof, a zero knowledge proof that they actually know that secret, and corresponding with how the commitment's made. Okay? The issuer issues a BBS signature, a BBS using blind BBS over the messages, the credential, plus the hidden secret. Okay. The holder needs to use their secret to generate a BBS proof. They never reveal their secret. They don't, that's just a message that's never revealed to the verifier. Okay. So we have the same properties we saw with public key holder binding, except we stay anonymous, or we keep our unlinkability. Okay. How anonymous? We may want to throw in pseudonyms on top of this. This is one of the things we discovered after looking at this stuff more. Now, we've gotten short on time, but that's about where we're at. Okay. So you may be thinking, wait, if people know how to do zero knowledge proofs and they're trying to do zero knowledge proofs for more general type of complicated functions for smart contracts and all sorts of things, might they try and do this for existing signatures, especially since right now roots of trusts only currently support ECDSA type signatures? Yeah, this could make an existing signature unlinkable. Okay, but this isn't easy. Right now, it might take about a gig or a couple hundred meg of space in about half an hour on a full laptop. I've tried some of these computations. Okay. So nothing's quite as efficient, will be as quite as efficient and practical as BBS in this scenario. But these are the kind of things we want for practical, as I'm quoting Anil John, we want practical privacy preserving cryptography for verifiable credentials, meaning that we got to work in the third party model too. Okay. I've been talking nonstop. Questions, comments. This is where we're at. I did not mean to do that. And we are trying to get all these requirements figured out, and we've kind of figured out that we really want both anonymous holder binding and pseudonyms at the same time.
Thanks, Greg. That was great. Does anyone have any comments or questions? I guess I have one. What is your opinion on like the limitations of using a BBS plus scheme for this anonymous holder binding? Like, why would people choose not to use it? Is it primarily because, I guess it's complicated, but also the cryptography isn't standardized and ratified by the international bodies?
That's where we're okay. So there's two different pieces. We'd like to get things ratified, standardized, and we see a bit of, hey, we're going to let the IETF kind of standardize it, and then maybe we'll bless it, those standards, those bodies. We did see with the UDARF stuff that a bunch of cryptographers all came out and said, you know, what you guys have isn't going to meet the requirements you put into the laws, and what you really should do is use BBS and variants of it. And then people came back and said, but we want a hardware root of trust. And then we said, oh, but then one person that worked on TPMs and algorithms for TPMs came back and said, oh, well, you know, we were working with TPM vendors and a lot of their stuff is done in firmware, and we were trying to get some of that stuff fixed up, and we could do this, this, and this. So it's fluid that way. And I will remind people that we got secure messaging, not because it got dictate or better private messaging, not because of it getting incorporated in the hardware, but because an open source effort like Signal went and did it well, made all the protocols, you know, they wrote them up nicely so people could cryptographically review them and implement them well. And then they privacy shamed the other guys, WhatsApp and Google, right? So it's like, are we going to wait for this, like, to get all the way down in hardware before we consider it? So that's why, one last sales pitch. Data integrity allows us to use multiple signatures, right? We can have a proof set. We can sign it with ECDSA, selective disclosure. We can sign it with BBS for selective disclosure. And so if somebody really doesn't trust one of those, they can use the other, right? We're not locked into one cryptographic scheme here.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think both of those things, but Signal, you know, like showed how maybe this can be done without relying on the government, and also,
We all like hardware roots of trust, but if you've ever tried to use a TPM yourself for an application, you'll go, gee, it only seems like the operating system vendors get to use these things for anything. And does that mean they're going to own the platform and we're not going to be able to use that good cryptography? Well, then we're going to have to figure out a way to do that maybe doesn't use the root of trust, but I am hopeful we can get access to some of those things because it's nice, right?
Well, thanks so much, Greg. I think we're at the time, if a bit over, so apologies about that. But we appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing your wisdom on this stuff.
Okay, great. Talk to everyone later.
Have a great week. See you later.